The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
And welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century of Lies, part two of my conversation with the award-winning journalist and New York Times bestselling author, Maya Solovitz. Keeping people alive. You know, that's a good segue. I wanted to ask you about a couple of things. We'll get back to your book in a second, but on July 7th, Rhode Island Governor Dan McKee signed into law a bill to allow establishment of supervised consumption sites called harm reduction centers in the state of Rhode Island. It's the first state in the union to do this. It's a two-year pilot project. At the time of this recording, as far as I know, there has been no response from the feds, nothing from ONDCP, nothing from the Department of Justice, which, you know, sued to stop Philadelphia from moving forward back in the previous administration under the person who shall not be named. So could you talk to me for a minute about the supervised consumption sites and the significance of Rhode Island's move?
I mean, it's really impressive, and I hope that that silence from the feds is golden and means that they're just going to let the science show what works, which in every other country that has done this, they have found that these safe consumption sites reduce HIV, improve people's health, get people into treatment, all the good stuff that you want. I mean, there's been this false idea in the American public that if you enable people who use drugs, or if you're nice to them, and if you don't make their lives miserable, then you're going to extend their addiction. And in fact, the opposite is true. If you treat people kindly and respectfully, they tend to begin to treat themselves better. And so, but everybody fears these safe consumption sites and the, people fear harm reduction because they think that it will lengthen somebody's addiction because it won't get bad enough for them to stop. And no, what it will do is keep them alive from and prevent them from getting so direly harmed that they will never get better. So anyway, safe consumption sites seem to be a really great place to help people stabilize their lives and help people avoid dying of overdose and avoid getting bloodborne illnesses. And where they've been done, particularly in Canada and Australia, they have reduced the death rate locally and helped people get into care. So I think it's really wonderful that this is actually happening. Do I think this is a solution to the overdose crisis? I do not, because you would need one on every corner and that's not gonna happen. Do I think that it will help some of the people who most need help? Absolutely. And wherever they can be, they should be. I think that we need to also, though, work more towards getting a safe supply to people.
Well, and could you talk for a minute about safe supply? Just on a recent show, I made a rather clumsy comparison between safe supply and substitution treatment, and I know that I was wrong. But just, I mean, so how wrong was I?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think there's different ways of using medications in addiction. One of the ways is providing a safe supply and just sheer harm reduction, because medical opioids are by their very nature safer than street opioids because they have the FDA overseeing safety and purity. And so you're not, if you actually get a prescription from your doctor, you're not going to randomly get fentanyl that was made in the street and is of widely varying purity. If you get fentanyl from your doctor, it will be of a known dose in a known administration method. And if you know your tolerance and know, you know, follow the doctor's instructions, you're not going to die of an overdose from it. But you can get street fentanyl in just about any pill that they're selling on the street, no matter what they're selling it as these days. And you can overdose almost immediately. So safe supply is basically people who are continuing to use drugs, probably not at the point where they're going to stabilize their lives. But if you give them a safe supply, they're more likely to live and therefore more likely to give a contribution to society like any other human being, because when you're dead, you really can't do that. So on the other hand, maintenance or medication treatment for addiction, within that, some people are really aiming for what looks completely like abstinence recovery. So aside from the fact that they have this substance in their body, they are functional, they are not using additional substances that cause problems for them, and they are working and contributing and being there for their families and all that good stuff. And one of the things that's sort of unique is for opioids as a class of medications is that if you take the same dose every day at the same time, you will not experience intoxication or consciousness alteration from it. And so basically, you know, I could be on a massive dose of opioids right now and you would not know because of that property. So like if I maintain you on alcohol, you're still going to be somewhat impaired, even though you might be less impaired because you have a greater tolerance than I do. But with opioids, it's not like that. And so some people, maybe they have a natural deficiency in their opioid system. Maybe they have something else, trauma, whatever. Anyway, for them, they function best staying on an opioid for life. And in the United States, we allow the use of methadone and buprenorphine for this purpose. And in Canada, they also allow morphine and Dilaudid and heroin itself in limited circumstances.
You know, this is a little bit of a tangent, but we're kind of on the subject, and it's you. You know about this stuff. Some of the research from years ago, I think Scotland, they were looking at patients enrolled in a methadone program, found that large number of them had had pain conditions, and they figured that basically they'd be getting the pain treated if they weren't on the methadone program. Of course, in this country, we have a rather odd relationship with pain. Where are we at, do you think?
It's absolutely horrible right now, and I am outraged that in our rush to get money out of the drug companies, we have sacrificed the lives of thousands of people, maybe millions of people in pain. Because in our rush to say opioids are cigarettes, we have coerced doctors into stopping prescribing for people for whom opioids are actually working. And so millions of people have had their doses either entirely discontinued or tapered down to lower than they need because the doctors are afraid to prescribe, because the drug companies over-marketed them. And the fact is that it is not correct to say opioids work for all chronic pain, but it is also not correct to say opioids don't work for chronic pain. So they work for some people, and those people shouldn't be getting messed around because the government thinks other people have addiction problems. I mean, one of the whole paradoxes of the current crisis is the fact that something like between 40 and 60% of people who get prescribed an opioid have leftovers. Now, this suggests that those people are definitely not addicted because they have leftovers, right? Those leftovers were the driver of the problems for the people who did develop addiction. 80% of those people got their opioids from somebody other than a doctor. So they didn't have a prescription for them. They got them from a friend or medicine cabinet of the family or whatever. But they started essentially with recreational drug use, not with pain, because most people in pain do not get addicted to opioids. And most people who get addicted do not do so in the context of chronic pain care. The situation where people end up on methadone to treat their pain is a testament to how horrible our policy is. Now, some people genuinely use methadone within the medical system to treat pain. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about people who pretend they have an addiction and go to a methadone clinic because what they really need is pain care. And we are putting more and more people into that kind of situation. And I talk to pain patients all the time who are just, you know, they're just much more disabled than they used to be. And they're angry about it, rightly so. So I'm hoping that, you know, once these legal cases are over, we can start to recognize, hey, this is more complex than opioids bad, everything else good. and that, you know, some people really benefit. I mean, we've been cutting off cancer patients and people who are dying. It's just, it's really outrageous. Like, we have these swings of the pendulum where it's like, everybody can have opioids, they're fine. No, nobody can have them, they're terrible. Obviously, the truth is somewhere in the middle, and we need to get there more quickly.
We did talk a bit ago about the stigma that used to be attached by the feds to the words harm reduction, and how it was anathema. Sorry, lean into the microphone. How it was anathema for a while. Then some of that changed, and of course, then it changed back. But we now have an acting drug czar, Regina LaBelle. The new guy hasn't been approved yet. He will be, but we have the acting drug czar, Regina LaBelle, has openly embraced harm reduction. She's spoken about it. She's actually, you know, she's advocated for some harm reduction interventions. What kind of, in terms of policy and in terms of how people do in the States, what kind of difference does it make having a drug czar who, well, in 2012 at that Harm Reduction Coalition conference here in Portland, Gil Kerlikowske, the then drug czar, sent a videotaped message. He couldn't be there in person, but he gave a keynote speech by video. You know, then a couple years later, Mike Botticelli actually spoke at the conference, at the Harm Reduction conference, in person, gave a keynote, standing ovations. What kind of difference does it make having the feds, you know, get over this attitude, you know?
I mean, I think it's enormously important. Is it all we need? No, of course it's not all we need. But having watched harm reduction go from this fringe and anathema sort of phrase that everybody was afraid to use to like the federal drug czar saying this is our official policy is an enormous change. Now, we've had much more of a shift among politicians to rhetorically support better drug policy than we have in them actually carrying out better drug policy. But at least they're not denouncing good policy anymore. And that is a step towards greater acceptance. I mean, you can have issues when things come into the mainstream, but you want them to come into the mainstream because you want them to be there for as many people as possible. And so harm reduction has really gone from a sort of fringe idea that they tried to suppress to being something that the Biden administration says it supports. How much support they will actually give in real life beyond things that at this point are very accepted, like needle exchange, which in the past federal funding was illegal for it, you know, it remains to be seen. But I think once people understand the idea of harm reduction, which is that in context, you must be focused on reducing harm, you can make drug policy that is much, much more effective. And the thing about harm reduction that drives people crazy who oppose it is that if it doesn't actually reduce harm, it doesn't count as harm reduction. So it's hard to argue against.
And people will try anyway, but...
Oh, of course they will.
Okay, let's get back to your book, because there was a... It's story of all the hero of a lot of the heroes who've done this, people who are unsung, or at least who are not as well known as they bloody should be, and it's your personal narrative as well, and it's, you know, your last book, Unbroken Brain, brilliant book, absolutely brilliant. Oh, I'll say this out loud, and I may even let this make it to the edit. I'm not really comfortable calling myself a person in recovery because I'm not sure I'm the one who can judge whether I've actually made any positive changes.
I will say that it is fine for you to call yourself a person in recovery because it sounds to me like you have made these changes and you are the only person who can actually make that determination. So I think it is safe and fair for you to say that.
Thank you, because I am doing much less alcohol than I have, and I'm no longer using cocaine. That's for many years now. So I think I'm doing better. I hope so. As a person,
you're
I'm not so sure.
You're the only one who can judge that. I mean, you know, it's like, yes, I'm sure we can all be deluded about various things, but I think we know in our heart of hearts when we're doing better.
This is part two of my conversation with Maya Solovitz. Her new book, Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Dear listener, for you, I want to complete that thought. I am a more sober person. More than that, I want to be a better person. I'm trying to be. I think that I am. The Prison Policy Initiative has issued a new report on criminal legal reform entitled Building Exits Off the Highway to Mass Incarceration, Diversion Programs Explained. Here with me to talk about that is Wanda Bertram, communications strategist with the Prison Policy Initiative. Wanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. We are a research organization focused on mass incarceration and over-criminalization. We've been around for coming up on 20 years. And, you know, we've always sort of mixed research and advocacy, looking at parts of the criminal justice system that not only affect people who are inside prisons and jails, but also affect their families, their friends, and really society at large. And publishing reports on that that later can be used to spark or to strengthen advocacy campaigns around issues, you know, related to voting, related to redistricting. We can get into that. That's a whole other conversation. Related to the costs that people pay to stay in touch with their loved ones behind bars. And the report that we wrote recently is about diversion programs, which are programs that counties, cities, or states can initiate to prevent people who are vulnerable or likely to end up in jail or prison, prevent those people from actually ending up there. And our report, the whole point of the report is to get policymakers to evaluate programs that are being considered and to figure out whether these programs are actually more punitive than necessary, if they're actually what is needed to solve the underlying social problems that are causing so many people to end up in prison. Absolutely. If folks want to check out our website, which I very much recommend you do, it's prisonpolicy.org. We're also on Twitter at prisonpolicy.
Again, folks, we've been speaking with Wanda Bertram, communications strategist with the Prison Policy Initiative. Their new report, Building Exits Off the Highway to Mass Incarceration, Diversion Programs Explained. You can find that at their website, prisonpolicy.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's go back for the rest of my conversation with Maya Solovitz, award-winning journalist and best-selling author. Her new book, Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. Back to the beginning, where you talked about that person who taught you very beginning of at the very beginning of the book, the person who taught you how to stay alive, basically how to stay alive and how to not get sick. You went out and found her.
Yes, and I haven't actually been able to meet her yet in person due to the pandemic, but we have spoken, and it was very cool after all these years of saying a friend of a friend and all these awkward phrasings to describe my relationship to her, to actually be able to say, yes, she's a friend, and also to actually know her name and be able to thank her. And it was really that phone call that we had was just enormously emotional for both of us, because I was just so grateful to her. And, you know, it is also a gift when you tell somebody how they changed your life. So I was able to, like, give that to her. And, you know, all of us, I think, go through periods where we feel like we're useless and nothing we do matters and all this kind of self-hating nonsense. But we, I think, all go through that at some point. And when somebody says, you saved my life, like, it's kind of hard to, like, get back into that self-hate loop. So I feel like it was, you know, I almost cried just thinking about it, because it was enormously amazing to actually contact Maureen Gammon. And I'm hoping that during the book tour, I get out to the West Coast and actually get to meet her in person.
It's a good thing we're not doing this by video, with video, because I tear up a lot. And if I saw you start to cry, I'd be bawling right now. I mean, I do find myself weeping, quite easily. Oh hell. So okay, you know, back in 1986, when you were first discovering harm reduction. Lean into the microphone, Doug. Back in 1986, when you were first discovering harm reduction, I was in Oregon working on Ballot Measure 5, the Oregon Marijuana Initiative. And back then, we told people that marijuana would one day become legal. They thought you'd been smoking a lot too much and maybe you ought to cut back on the beer. Any of this other stuff, supervised consumption sites, safe supply, Yeah. I'm just saying, we've seen a lot of changes over these years. Where do you think drug policy is going over the next couple of decades?
So, I mean, it's funny because when you talk to people who are on the ground working in harm reduction, they're dealing with the day-to-day problems. They don't see any progress. They think we're going nowhere. But when you get a historical view, like I did in writing this book, you see, holy cow, right. Everybody would have thought you were stoned if you said marijuana would become legal in the United States. And it's pretty close. Now, we, of course, always have to worry about a backlash. And I think, you know, it's hard to know what will happen in these crazy times that we're in. But right now, we're on a really good trajectory. We are moving away from the racist drug policies that we have historically had. And people are not standing up in favor of them. There aren't people going around saying, we need more drug war. You know, people are having to like make an attempt at a harm reduction argument to support the lousy stuff that's going on. So that itself shows an enormous change. Now we have to hold their feet to the fire and make sure they actually do harm reduction and move more towards, like, I think decriminalization is the next big thing. And I think that harm reduction absolutely taught people that that has to happen because we have zero evidence whatsoever that putting people in a cage for possessing substances does anything other than waste money, increase overdose risk, and harm people's lives. We have no, you know, nobody can prove that this helps anybody anywhere. You know, some occasional people might say, oh, it saved my life. But if you look at the actual data, not so. So anyway, decriminalization is essential. We don't treat any other disease this way. We don't put people in jail for possession of alcohol or tobacco and expect that to cure alcohol problems. Or tobacco problems. We don't do this for diabetes. We don't do this for any illness. We recognize that jail is depressing and traumatizing and not helpful. So recognizing, nowadays, like nobody can even speak up in favor of criminalization. What they say is, oh, we should arrest people and put them in treatment. Now that is slightly perhaps a step up, but we don't do that for any other condition. And it is not what we do now. We arrest people and put them in jail where they cannot get treatment. So it's just an enormous waste of money. Nobody can actually, I keep asking people for a rational argument for keeping it, and nobody can come up with one because their argument in the past was, it sends the message that drugs are bad. And now we realize that sending a message by harming people isn't really a good way to send a message. You know, you should use the internet or something.
Years ago, Paul Maddock wrote about the limitations of reform, the idea being that the authorities, whether it's the bosses, the bourgeoisie, whatever, the power structure, would dole out minor reforms and minor improvements to the lives and working conditions so that basically the workers would grumble and get angry, and then things get worse, and then they start to organize and agitate, and so to keep to keep people from organizing and from becoming a threat, the power structure doles out, say, limited reforms, little doodahs, little goodies, to try and dissuade the anger. And so, as the anger lessens, then we reach equilibrium. Things are okay. We've made enough reforms. Now we can stop. So we're talking about drug policy reforms. I'm thinking about, do you think marijuana legalization has helped drug policy reform, or has it held it back in some way?
I mean, I think we need to get rid of these dumb arguments that like marijuana is a special case and everything else should stay illegal. I think that the people who made that argument within the reform movement, that was not the right way to go. I mean, it's certainly a good argument to make that marijuana is less harmful than many, many, many other substances. And I'm not saying you shouldn't make that argument, but saying that this means that marijuana should be legal and the other things should still be heavily criminalized. Well, if it doesn't help somebody with marijuana problems to put them in a cage, why would it help somebody with heroin, right? And so this is where I think the harm reduction concept really helps, because it lets you realize that, okay, what do we want? We want people to survive. We want them to be healthy. We want them to be happy. how does criminalizing massive amounts of people, mostly people of color, achieve that? I mean, I guess it achieves something for racists, but for the rest of us, I think that it is not really effective and it is doing an enormous amount of harm. And I don't think anybody wants to come out and say, okay, there's maybe some minority that does, but I don't think most people want to come out and say, yes, more racist policy, that would be great. No, that's not what people want. I think there's always going to be co-optation when a movement becomes mainstream, but we just need to keep going. And I think that, you know, marijuana legalization has actually done an enormous amount of good for policy reform simply by not having the sky fall.
The book again is Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. It's available through all the usual outlets and wherever very fine books are sold. We're coming up to the end of of my hour, and I am so very grateful to you for the time, Maya. You are one of the most brilliant journalists I've ever read, and you're a really good writer, and you're really inspiring. Complete the thought from earlier, reading Unbroken Brain really did help a lot really did help me a lot. And I'll be a little more comfortable defining myself as someone in recovery.
It is a funny thing because you don't want to like claim other people's whatever. But I do think that, it's a term that is there for all of us. And I think the more of us that claim this through paths that are not the traditional path, the easier it becomes for other people to recover because they see that the traditional path is not the only way.
So now give me your social media, give me your website, all the stuff that people need to know so they can follow you and your work. And hold on for a second. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, great. So my website is mayaszz.com. That is MAIASZ.com, which is like my first name and the first two letters of my very complicated last name. On social media, I am most likely to be found on Twitter, and that is at MayaSZ also. And between those two things, I should usually keep up with those things, and you should be able to find the information you need.
Oh, Maya Salovitz, thank you so much. That was the second half of my conversation with the New York Times bestselling author and award-winning journalist, Maya Salovitz. You can find part one at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. Maya's new book is called Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. It's an excellent book by a brilliant author. Find out more at Maya's website, which is mayaszz.com. That's MAIASZ.com.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies, and I have been Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.